Welcome back into the Daft on Draft episode. I'm your host, Corey Kinnon, Fake Corey Kinnon on Twitter. You can find my draft content either on my Substack, but more frequently it's on SI Draft, which is kind of where I'm doing my draft content now, which is kind of cool. So you can go over to sportsillustrated.com/NFL/draft as their draft site, and that's where I'm kind of doing some things. But today's episode, we are going to continue on our scouting series, and today we're going to do defensive linemen. It's a pretty big episode, doing edge rushers and defensive tackles all in one group. And with me today to break down what to watch for when watching defensive linemen is John Ledyard. John, you might have remembered back in the day from his time on Locked On NFL Draft Podcast, the Daft Network. Now he's got his own Substack, doing some things with Ali Canali, doing some really cool stuff independently there. And we talked for an hour. About breaking down edge rushers, breaking down defensive tackles. So it's a really extensive episode. So I'm not going to linger up front here because, again, I want to get you straight to that content because it is a longer episode. So this is it. What to watch for when watching defensive linemen with John Ledyard. All right. Now welcoming in John Ledyard of the Audibles and Analytics podcast and the Yins No Ball podcast. John, are you ready to talk some defensive linemen?
I've never been more ready, Corey. This is my favorite position to scout. I love this position. If I could just scout one position for the rest of time, I would be perfectly content scouting defensive line players, edge players, three techniques, nose tackles, all of the above. It is the most enjoyable position to scout and probably the one I've thought the most about in terms of a process and the intricacies and the details of the position. So I thought it was really cool when you reached out about doing a show like this. I was pretty excited to get the opportunity to join you and get into the weeds on this stuff.
I love it. I asked you because what I have come to realize is there's a lot of things that are like, that's a non-negotiable for me. Like that's not a non-negotiable for me. And I'll post something on Twitter and you'll respond and be like, yeah, dude, I see it that way. Or like, you'll post something like, wait, I think that too. So I was like, this would be a great conversation. I think one of the big traits we'll get to when we get there about a non-negotiable, but that we see eye to eye and why a player who went top 10 last year, both of us were in the same boat of like, I don't think this guy's a top 30 player and he's going to go top 10. If we're talking about the guy the Raiders drafted 10th overall last year in Tyree Wilson, there's a really key component as to why. And I'm really excited to get into the details. But John, again, I've been following your work for a very long time. I had Trevor on to do tight ends. He talked about tight ends and just the days of mowing my grass and throwing my headphones in and just throwing on the old Locked On Draft podcast back in the day. Yeah. So it's a cool moment to have you on and to chop this up with you.
That's cool. Thanks for saying that, by the way. Like I always, it's one of the greatest blessings to me, I think, to hear people talk about Locked On NFL Draft still. And I still get DMs this day. It just blows my mind. And I know Trevor and I talk about it a lot and just very cool to have the opportunity to do that for sure. So that's fun to hear.
It's like a where were you moment. Like, where were you when you heard the Ed Oliver off ball? Where were you in that moment? Yeah. I was driving to the YMCA to play some pickup basketball. I know exactly where I was going.
That's right.
But let's dive into this. Let's start with edge. So we're going to break it down. We'll do edge first. We'll do interior defensive lineman second. Kind of separate a little bit where they're similar, where they're different. Make a little Venn diagram out of this thing. So let's start with edge. And the first thing I want to talk about really has nothing to do with traits. So again, throughout this podcast, we really want to get into what are we watching for when we're scouting each position that we're talking about. And talking about edge, I really want to start with body typing. So really not a trait, just kind of how a player is built. How much stock do you put into body typing in your evaluations? And do you find that you have like a bias towards or against a certain body type of edge rusher?
Yeah, it's a good question. I honestly don't feel like I have like a significant bias towards any type. I honestly always enter tape evaluations with this player's got to prove to me that they're worth being drafted, you know, first round, second round, third round, fourth round, highly, lowly, whatever it is. You know what I mean? They've got to prove basically they're worth to me in a lot of ways, like as a player, obviously. And so that I try to take that process into the evaluation and start there. No matter the body type. Now, we're human. We can't help sometimes and see, you know, physical prototype. Like, you know, I think Tyree Wilson caught a lot of people. That's a lot of their type, I would say. For me, the physical body type probably matters a lot less than the athletic traits, which I'll talk probably more and more in depth about on this show. But the physical body type, it's never bad to have great physical traits. However, I think it's deceptive what people look for. A lot of the things people like are like big, tall, strong, long, and those things can be helpful. And sometimes they can be completely meaningless. And so you just have to be careful. It's not like it's ever just by itself. Oh, this is negative. Although I think some of the height stuff we can talk about on this show, like, I'm not so sure it's the advantage people think that it is at these frontline positions. You know, obviously there's accompanying traits, right? Typically, if you're taller, you're also bigger and stronger if you play on this position. And so there can be positives about it. And we're talking specifically about edge rushers here. So those things can be positives, but I don't think by themselves, they necessarily should always be listed, you know, top of the strength section. Oh, he's 6'6" and he has long arms. Maybe that helps, but maybe he's so reliant on using his length that he's never tried another pass rush move in his life. And there's not many guys that are winning off just length in the NFL. You have to have the moves. You have to have the process as a pass rusher, and you really need the athletic gift. So it can be a strength that isn't always necessarily. So for me, I would say, yeah, very little adherence to specific body types, I would say, for me. I more than anything look at athletic and physical, some physical two traits that we are going to talk about, I think, more on the show. But there are a lot of people that certainly believe that length is like a big qualifier, disqualifier. And I think it may have disqualifying principles if a guy's arms are Sutton Smith level, you know, short. It may have disqualifying traits, but I rarely think that arm length is a qualifier, meaning that great arm length would make you somebody you want to draft highly, period. You know, I don't think of it as that. Whereas you can think about production that way from a wide receiver standpoint or certainly other positions in the field, saying, oh, yeah, a guy was achieved this by this age. We talk about breakout age and things like that, that other positions, they must be there. They are likely to be a high pedigree prospect because of those things. Most of, to me, I like that may be true, but for edge guys, I think more than anything, there can be certain thresholds that you probably don't see hit very often that are disqualifiers for players, but rarely would I use length or physical traits as a qualifier for a player.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's where my bias lies, is I tend to not really like those 6'6" dudes because I think they give up their chest a lot. Yeah. It's pretty rare for a dude who's 6'6", 6'7", to have knee bend, to have flexibility, to like not have high pad level, to not expose their chest. So I almost prefer like the 6'2", 6'3" dudes who have some length, because I think if you're thinking about pad level, again, you can be 6'5" and have really good knee bend and still be able to create those leverage points. But if you're 6'2" and you kind of are that squatty build and you have some length, like those are some natural levers. And I want to preface this next part by saying, like, Kentley Platt is a great dude and RAS is a great tool to use. But I think one of the things that I struggle about RAS is you see like this guy's 6'7" and 280 pounds. He's the 99th percentile. And that like boosts his RAS, but that's not always a great thing. Right. So I think that's a good thing to be aware about as well. And that's a great segue into the next part. It's really about less body typing to an extent. And again, less, you know, Sutton Smith is a good one where people are like, that guy needs to be playing off ball because he's just so short. There are some disqualifying, but for the most part, it's about the tools. And so, you know, the next part I want to just ask about here, John, is do you have any non-negotiable for edge rushers? Like if they don't have this, I'm not talking about them in the top 50. I'm not talking about them in the top 100.
Yeah, I actually do. One of the things I wanted to say, one more thing on that last topic that we talked about, and then I'll jump right into talking about my things, my gotta habits, which isn't a long list, but it is an important list, I think. One of the things I want to mention with the body typing that you talked about, just because I think it's really important, is you mentioned being biased against certain body types, kind of like inherently, like looking at some of the, you know, big, long, strong, and saying like, oh, I have some questions. Like, we'll see. Like, they better prove to me that they can play a certain way. And that is a good way of looking at it. And I actually hadn't thought about that when you first asked. But I do think that's how – I think I enter that way with all prospects, hopefully. But I definitely do with that type. Like, can you show me that you can play low? Can you show me that you can play with Ben? And the other thing is, a lot of the time, those body types have been the biggest, longest, strongest at their position the whole way up. You know, you think of a Marcus Davenport, right, as a type. Those guys are so big, long, and strong that Tyree Wilson's going to be the ultimate example of this that I know we're going to talk about a good bit today on the show, that they really haven't won any other way. And they've been able to achieve interest of NFL teams as a highly touted draft prospect that you take top 10, that you trade up for in the first round in Davenport's case, it without really doing much more than being big, long, and strong. And obviously, you know, in some people's minds, I think Davenport was this great athlete too. I don't know that that was quite ever obvious on tape, but, you know, I think that is enough. So because that's been enough, a lot of these guys haven't learned how to actually pass rush. And that is a big, big issue. So it's not necessarily just that their body type means they aren't a good pass rusher, but often it is applied to those physical prototypes have not been developed as pass rushers because they've been so reliant on physical traits. And one of the most dangerous things we can do as evaluators is say, no, physical traits as an edge rusher, those are the top thing. Because in the NFL, almost all physical traits, they're always helpful in getting to the end goal, but almost all physical traits gets minimized. The advantages you once had don't exist in the NFL anymore when it comes to physical traits, almost across the board. Now, there's certainly physical traits that matter, but they're almost always coupled with very refined skill or technique, very refined process, very refined awareness of how to get to whatever helps you win as a player, a variety of processes that help you win as a player too, not just relying on one single thing. All of those things I think are really important, and the physical traits can be the bedrock of that stuff and are very important as the bedrock. You need them as the bedrock of that stuff, but very rarely are the physical traits going to be by themselves the superlative when you talk about a player's NFL evaluation. And in college, sometimes they are the evaluation for a lot of these players who've even been drafted in the first round. And that's problematic to me because that's putting the cart before the horse, in my opinion, because you need this other stuff that we're about to talk about. That stuff can be fine as being part of the mix, but you need other traits. So for me, non-negotiables at this position, there are very rare few cases. Carl Lawson's one of them. And so I can actually think of the exceptions, like, because I can count them probably on one hand, where I think an edge rusher isn't going to be very good or great, you know, depending on the round grade that I give them, great to good or very good, whatever, at winning outside hip of the tackle in the NFL. If you can't do that as an edge rusher, there's almost no path to you being successful in the NFL. Now, Lawson, I mentioned as an example, so I'll just quickly just address that. You know, there's probably been others too off the top of my head. I'm trying to think of who they might be. But Lawson could win the edge a little bit in college because of his power, and he had such great cross chop at the top of the arc. And he wasn't ever the bendiest guy, but he could turn. He just knew how to get his body turned and angled. I don't think it was totally non-existent in the NFL for him, but he was kind of the perfect case of, like, when we're talking about physical traits, he's probably one of the most jacked edge rushers we've ever seen. And his hump move combined with what he was shorter, low pad level, his hump move was unbelievable until he got obviously injuries just destroyed, excuse me, any chance he had at being a really, really good player. And so he was probably one unique exception in that this guy, he may never corner at a high rate, or like he may never be able to really threaten guys in their outside hip that much. But his hot move is just going to be so devastating, and he has so much power to cross face, and his pad levels, leverage, everything's going to translate that we might roll the dice on him anyway. I think I had him – this was early. I was early as an evaluator, but I had him like 18th on my board, I think, and he went obviously in the fourth round, I think, and ended up being a real big hit for me until he got destroyed by injuries. But there are very few outliers, right? So you have to be able to win outside hip at the tackle, and there's a lot of into the process of how that happens, but – I think that's the really important part, is winning in that plane.
Yeah, I think we've talked about Tyree Wilson a lot. So just ripping the bandaid off completely here, talking about big, fast, strong. When you're in the NFL level, every single player that you're going against is a top tier athlete at their level. So it's much different from the college level, where you're going against future insurance salesmen, future realtors. Like that's the reality of, like, not every offensive tackle you're going against is making the NFL. And you can work through their chest a lot at the NFL level. But in Wilson's case, dude is stiff as a board. Dude is stiff as a board. There's really no ability to play outside of his frame. And so when you're going to the NFL level, then again, you're taking on offensive tackles who are top 64 in the world. at playing offensive tackle. Like, that's the nature of playing in the NFL. That's not a thing you're going to be able to do anymore. And so having that ability to win outside shoulder, and now breaking that down a little bit more into like what it takes to win outside shoulder, just defining terms like, John, in your opinion, what does it mean to have bend? When somebody says this edge rusher has a lot of bend, man, like he's a rubber band, he's Gumby, he's got a lot of bend. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to show up in different ways for different players, for sure. We talk a lot about ankle bend or hip bend, flexibility, and sometimes they come all in the same package, right? A player might have really significant or really good ankle flexion at the top of the arc. Yannick Ngakoue was probably a good example of this at his prime anyway. Robert Quinn probably had both, I guess, now that I think about it. But those guys are like two guys who won almost always outside edge, you know, of the tackle. And I don't think either were ever thought of typically as like Quinn had a year or two maybe where he was just such a good corner that he might have. Like, they never had other aspects from their game for the most part. But they were so good at winning at that level, they literally built a career out of it because that's how good they were winning just on that one plane. So that is just how much that accesses you when you can bend and turn like that. With Yannick, he was always more of a tilter than a bender, I would say. And that's like I use that phrase for ankle flexion guys, where it's almost like they more tilt their way to the quarterback. You know, Chandler Jones, great example of that, like great tilter, not going to bend like Von Miller. Like, he's not going to run under a table at full speed like a Von Miller. But if you want somebody to tilt the edge and their body's basically horizontal like that, or almost horizontal to the ground, but they're still like running, but they're not necessarily bent over, right? That is a good those are great example players of that, where it looks a little bit different. Now you get your Von Miller types and you talk about elite bend, right, and flexibility at the top of the arc. Your Robert Mathis types, you know, those guys are going to have some of those things as they're in their calling cards, that are more hip flexion, what I would say. And I would call that more bend. Now, I think they can all be grouped in the same thing for what it's worth, but they're different. If we're getting into scouting technicalities, things like that, you can certainly talk about the different types of bend that those denote. So different things for different players. I think it can all work because explosiveness is the most important trait for an edge rusher, I think, or any defensive line player. What you do off the ball is the most important thing about the position. But I always talk about the four pillars of pass rush athleticism. People who followed me for years have heard me write about this and talk about it. So I apologize if people are doing it and have heard this a bunch of times before, but you need to be the four pillars. You need to have at least, I think, some of these, most of them, all of them, you know, it depends the level of greatness or how great you are in a specific area. But to me, your burst and explosiveness off the ball in your first step, your speed up the arc, right? How well much can you sustain that initial burst up the ball? Can you continue to gain ground? Or are you just like your first movement's eruption as soon as the ball is snapped, but then after that, you don't have any speed to speak of? You know, Lawson was a little bit that way, honestly, where he had no speed, but his first step was great. So he threatened you immediately, but he couldn't really, like, once you got hip to what he was doing, you couldn't really, like, you weren't really afraid of his speed once you realized, like, oh, this guy doesn't have any speed after his first step. And so that's why the difference and distinction there, I say, like, both are important, but I would say the first one is quickness and burst off the ball. Second one is speed up the arc, right, to get to the edge. Third one is bend or flexibility. We talked about that as hip, as ankle. That can manifest itself in some different ways, but that part's really important. And then change of direction, right? Can you cross face? Can you set yourself up as a speed counter threat? Even if you're not, you know, Charles Harris was a great speed counter rusher in college. In the NFL, he didn't have that level of athleticism for it to carry over. But you certainly saw plenty of examples of it if you watched his college tape of this guy speed off the edge and then he counters, you know, whether it's a spin or just like a Euro step type of deal, something like that. But he was just able to threaten on different planes largely just because of that one factor, even if he was never a great cornering threat. And then the NFL guys were like, oh, you can't corner on us. Like, you're not explosive enough and you can't bend. So we're just going to sit on your inside move. And then he just had a hard time making a career of it after that. But it's a good example of like guys that win in different ways, but you need the traits to be at a high enough level for it to translate to the NFL. You know, Derek Barnett was a guy that like could never won with a power move in his life. And he had to become a really different player in the NFL. And he's had an okay career. He's never lived up to, you know, I think he was the 14th pick, but he was a guy that had to just like, he was a corner, he was a bender in college, and He just didn't have those traits in the NFL. Like, he was never explosive enough to play that way in the NFL. So the explosiveness is always has to be the first step. If you can do that high level, then your bend can really come into play. But if you're not explosive enough, then that bend may never come into play. Jared Verse is kind of the inverse of this past year, where like nobody will question his explosiveness or should if they watch his tape. He's really twitchy off the ball, but the bend and flexibility at the top of the arc is a big concern to me. Like, can he corner? When he tried to corner a lot in college, he fell down a ton. And this is something Ollie and I talked about a lot as we watched him more and more, was I don't know if he's going to be able to win that way in the NFL. Okay, can he win as a bull rusher? Because he won a lot that way in college. That's how he won, because he couldn't corner. He would go through guys' chests. He reverse pancaked the guy like every game. In the NFL, how many edge rushers are reverse pancaking guys? How many smaller? He weighs plenty. He's fine enough in that regard. But like, how many edge rushers that won't be physical outliers in a positive way, like, are putting offensive tackles on the ground on a consistent basis? Not many. And that's not how they're winning as a process very often. So you just have to be able to talk through it. I love Jared Verse's college tape. Then you think about, how will it translate to the NFL? Will he be able to be a top 20 caliber player in the NFL if he can't win high side as a rusher? Okay, what does he have? What's his other cards to play? And I think he had some of those other cards. But it's such a disqualifier for me, Corey, that like, I got really concerned about his evaluation and end up, he was not a first round graded player for me, because I just worry that he won't be able to win or threaten high side in the NFL. And in the NFL, tackles are just going to sit on your power, sit on your inside moves. They're not going to be afraid of you unless you can threaten them. He's explosive enough that he might, but he's just not that bendy. And so I worry that his lack of flexibility and ability to corner is going to hurt what might be what his ceiling might be in the NFL.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because before he went back to school and just listening to some other podcasts, I'm like, I think Jared Verse is a top 10 player. And I watched his tape and I bought in, because the Syracuse game where he's going against Matthew Bergeron, he makes Matthew Bergeron look like a UDFA. Like that Syracuse tape is unbelievable. So that's where I started to buy in. But then the more I saw it, I was like, anytime this dude tries to play outside of his frame, he loses his footing, like every single time. And so I think a good way to wrap up the bend conversation is, this is the way that I always look at it. Sometimes I even like, I'll like take a snippet of my screen of a player I'm watching and I'll take it into Paint and I will literally draw, like, with the line, like I will draw a line down his furthest outside shoulder. And I will look, how far are your ankles? How far are your feet from that outside, like the outside point of your shoulder? And are you playing well from out there? And if the answer is yes, then it's like, I'm going to buy into you. So I think that's maybe a good way to define bend for this conversation, because you said it doesn't really matter for hips. It doesn't really matter for ankles, but how far can a player play outside of their frame, where their feet are, how far outside of their shoulder can they play, mm-hmm. of their shoulder alignment can they play, and can they do it well?
Tricky thing to figure out, you know, and we haven't even talked about some other aspects of evaluating bend in it, like the depth of a quarterback in the pocket. That's a really important one of this too, because in the NFL, typically, I guess nowadays there honestly is more because a lot of these quarterbacks play their own way. So there isn't, like back in the day, it was like,
nope, you got to turn a corner real tight. Yeah.
You're 7, 8, 9 yards in the pocket. Like nowadays, a lot of these guys are so athletic at quarterback, they'll bail out of the back of the pocket. And, you know, you do have a little bit more of a going, but typically if you're talking about just from a process standpoint of evaluating a trait, you're going to say, okay, is a quarterback 7 to 9 yards deep in the pocket, or is he 10, 11, 12 yards? Even a yard can make a big difference past the set point. And so it's not really bend or flexibility. You're cornering, but you're only cornering when the quarterback's too deep. And so it's not really, you're not really beating the tackle. You're just taking advantage of the fact that the quarterback has no idea where he's supposed to be in the pocket and the tackle can't see him because his back's to him. And so that's a really important part of it, is that we can't get so excited about a player's about. This is why I always say in scouting, like, it's so important to be critical. And I know people don't always like to hear that, because they want to go in and just be like, I want every prospect that they to make them fall in love with them. And so you're pre-inclined to try to fall in love with every prospect that you watch, rather than say, okay, well, is this actually like this high end of a rep as I'm seeing? And in the NFL, players have to prove it to you on tape. Like, hardly any of these guys are great. That's just the reality. And so you have to be able to look for, like, okay, I see this rep. It looks good on the first glance. Is it all the things that I thought it was in first blush? Like, am I seeing the traits that I actually think I'm seeing when I watch it? Or is the quarterback too deep in the pocket? Or is he bailing out into the guy? Or was the tackle tripped? Or did the tackle not know the snap count? And so it looks like he's just whipping this guy to the edge, but all of a sudden you look in the tackle, like, was the snap count was a second. He wouldn't even move at the snap. And he's like clearly confused about what the snap count was. Like, it's like, oh, that might be a good rep for the edge rusher, but it doesn't mean it's a rep that will be applicable to the NFL, right? Because that's not going to happen on every snap. So you really have to weed through everything to be able to find what you're looking for. And, you know, it should be a hard process to fall in love with the player the way, you know, I did with Latu, for example, or things like that. Like, that shouldn't happen necessarily that easily. So I think being back to your point about being able to play outside your frame, I mean, that Tyree Wilson's another example of this, because he would try to, right, in a lot of different ways, and you could see the issues when that happened. Some of that time that shows up as a cornering effort. You saw that with Verse, and you talked about that with him, where he'd end up on the ground because he couldn't play at those angles, right, that you need to. With Wilson, it was a lot of overextension. It wasn't necessarily being on the ground, but it was overextension and losing yourself, right? So when you talk about creating speed to power, right, like, you're talking about being low to the ground and uncoiling yourself up into the pads of a player. He would pop straight up and then just run into a player and push, but with no leverage. And so you were almost getting this overextension then at a certain point, because he was working so hard, his legs would start to fall behind on reps and his arms would get way out over outside of his frame. And then he would be overextended, but it would be like, he would be way too high too. His hips would be too high. And so you got a lot of good reps against tight ends just because he could physically overpower him even without being leveraged. But when it came to reps that he would had to be leveraged against guys to be able to create speed to power, you saw a lot of issues, I think. And so, you know, who knows what Wilson's career, I don't want to write the book too quickly on his career. I have been wrong about guys that I was way lower on than consensus before. Russo is probably an example of that. And, you know, he's turned into a really good player in Buffalo. He was a player I was lower than consensus on. And I have prided myself on being better disqualifier of edge rushers than other people have been, just because of seeing, oh yeah, this doesn't work with a lot of guys over the years. But Russo's one that got me. I didn't think he'd be as good in the NFL as he's been. And I was lower on Wilson. He was like a late third round grade for me. I thought he was a low caliber starter or a rotational player in the NFL. And obviously rookie year was rough, but we'll see. But I didn't see a lot of the things that I thought were issues with him are things that I didn't necessarily think would be learned. He would learn how to do them better at a higher rate, because I didn't think he necessarily had what it took to be able to do those things better, honestly, from an athletic standpoint. So time will tell if that's right or not.
Yeah, I think that's another segue. I think we've covered the explosiveness aspect. I think you really hammered that home of ability to convert speed to power. So when you do come off the edge and you do initiate contact, do you have the leverage? Do you have the power, the explosiveness to continue your leg drive and continue to generate movement towards the quarterback? I think is a pretty good way to define that. And I think you talked about the motor, you talked about the burst, the first step. But you mentioned something there at the end of what you just said that I think is a perfect segue into the next thing I want to talk about. And that's, you said there's some things that I don't think are, like, essentially you said, I don't think there are some things that were coachable, like that I don't think he could have improved on, that could be coached up. And I think that's a really difficult part of evaluating talent as well. Like, does this player have something and the rest that he doesn't have, is that coachable? Or does this player have something, but he's pretty capped out because that's all coaching and that the traits aren't. So I think Danielle Hunter out of USC a few years ago might be a good case of this, right? Like, complete athletic freak, raw as could be. And I think for a better, like Odafe Owe is another case of this, like went first round of the Ravens. But when I watched Odafe's tape, I was like, this guy's just a freak. But the stuff that he did lack are like, well, he doesn't have a pass rush plan at all. Like, he's kind of doing the same thing. He's just exploding off the ball and trying to win with power. But like, he has the traits that you can work with. So one of those traits that I think are probably most coachable are like a player's pass rush plan and how they use their hands. So that's kind of where I want to go next. Like, how coachable do you think it is if you see a guy like, again, Hunter coming out of USC, really no plan, just winning with his power, but he's developed into a really nice player. How coachable do you think it is for a player who doesn't have a good pass rush plan out of college to develop that?
I think it's very coachable. It just probably is going to happen in your independent sessions rather than with teams. Teams just don't spend a lot of time training it. I'm sure there's exceptions to the rules. I've been around a couple teams. They don't spend a lot of time training it necessarily during their practice times. You need to come ready to do that stuff when you show up. So a lot of it will be determined by who you decide to train with in the non-season months, in the off season. And there's a lot of good guys out there, and that's why pass rushers are hitting at a rate. better than they've ever hit at is because the Chuck Smiths of the world and some of these other guys who've worked with players and started these clinics and now offensive line's responding and they're doing their thing. And that part of player growth and development has just been unbelievable the last couple of years. And so the players that are doing those things, and now it's pretty much everybody, you have to do it if you're going to be a great one. You need to work with people in the offseason, and it's just all hands, man. It's hands, it's speed, it's hand-eye coordination. That's what they do. And so everybody's doing it. So that is a big helpful thing, I think, for players, is that there's going to be access and opportunity to be able to do this stuff at a better level than it's ever been done before. I think we touched on speed to power a little bit, but that is where this conversation starts, I think, because hand usage is such a broad term. It can literally be a ghost move where you don't actually even use your hands. Right. You feel use them. Like it's
I like to define it as pass rush plan. So that's why I like to define it as pass rush plan, because again, it could be a ghost move. It could be you're trying to force an overset with a strong like outside step first and come inside. So I like to define it more as like pass rush plan for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes complete sense because oftentimes the guys who are best with their hands, like a Latu, for example, are just thinking on the move, right? They're literally responding to what you show them and how quickly they can do that. And the reason Latu is special to me as a prospect is I've never seen anybody be able to do that with the quickness he's able to do it with. Like his processing of just what is coming at him from an opponent standpoint is just jaw dropping, like how quickly he processes on the move. And he has plans, but he just adapts on the fly to what is being thrown at him better than anybody I've seen in that specific area, at least. But the speed to power thing is so important because it isn't necessarily how you are going to win in the NFL as an edge rusher. Like it will help you. It will be an important part of things, but it is a bedrock more so for setting up a lot of other things. You have to be able to at least threaten with speed to power. Can you be a physical obstacle for the player that's across from you? Like we are going to talk about a lot of different things, but Corey, the reality is that this game is a physical one. And so you have to be able to be a physical threat. You know, it is just really important, I think. Now, it isn't as important as some of the other stuff I talked about, the pillars of athleticism and all of that stuff. Not necessarily, but you're not going to be a speed to power threat if you don't explode off the ball. Like these guys who are like, oh, they're big and long, like in college, like they might push you back or knock you back or, you know, things like that. People are talking about Brandon Dorlus playing on the edge because he knocked Troy Fautanu down one time in the game. It's like, dude, that's not it. Like if you can't get off the ball explosive enough, like as an edge, Dorlus is not explosive. As an inside player, he tested a lot better. He's smaller. We'll see if it works. I liked him. I didn't love him. I thought he was fine. But as an edge, like there was just no shot. So people, when they were ranking him with edges, I was kind of like, well, what about him makes you think he's an edge? Because it ain't his body type. It ain't his athletic testing. Like this guy doesn't look like any edge in the league. Like even Autry's a better looking body than this guy. And, you know, he looks like Melvin Ingram, like current Melvin Ingram, if you want to get like where Melvin Ingram just doesn't even look like, I don't even know if he's on a team right now, but he spent like 3 years somehow being like playable in the NFL. And he looks like he just ate cheeseburgers all off season. And so there's some guys like that, I think, on the edge that like, it's like, okay, well, if Dorlus is that, so he's going to be, where are the traits that show me he's going to be able to win as an edge and in space? And teams just attacked him when he was on the edge in college in space and forced him into those situations. And so speed to power is great. It can't be the top thing for you as an edge defender because other things matter more. But if you have that arrow in your quiver, all of a sudden you've set up everything else, right? Because now you can do long arms, you can swim guys because they're okay. What's one of the most important aspects of being able to swim players is you're threatening in some way to attack their frame. Then all of a sudden you don't, right? You bypass their frame. So if you're not a threat to attack their frame, they're not going to brace for it. They're not going to punch. They're not going to try to land first contact. They're going to wait you out and be patient if all you've ever done is finesse moves all game. So can you be a threat with that at all is really important. And people rag on Myles Garrett, as you know, for just doing this, I think, too often. And it's like, well, Myles Garrett is one of the lowest pad levels in the league despite being huge. And he's one of the most explosive players in the league off the ball. What more important traits? Plus, his arms are bigger than my head. So what is more important for being a great speed to power rusher than having those things? And I don't think anything is. And so that's where with him, it just gets to the point where, man, it's just like, this is what you want. Like, and he's so talented that he can win that way. And I know that there's other aspects to his game that are awesome too. And that he's one of the best cornering rushers in the league as well. But I really just think like that when you can offer those kind of traits, you should be trying to win speed to power, at least on a percentage of your plays, to keep people honest, but also to threaten physically and say, okay, this is going to set up all the other handwork I do because you think that I can be a threat to get into your pads, and that's going to change your strike timing, your all those things in offensive tackle, like your placement, your hand usage, all those things. Once I've gotten in a position where I can dictate terms from a hand fighting perspective, then I'm in a superior position, especially late in the game, to be able to deploy other responses to whatever I've forced you to do as a player, because I can attack your frame.
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, if you are attacking with speed to power as well, like, you are compromising balance of the man across from you as well. Because what that's gonna naturally do for a good offensive tackle, I would think, if somebody gets that deep into an offensive tackle's chest, like, they're just gonna try to drop their anchor. Like, that's it. They're just gonna, that at that point, they're like, all right, it's time to drop. Boom. If you can get them to drop your anchor, then if you can find a move off of that, you've got their balance questioned as well. I kind of want to transition now, and I want to use the run game as a way to transition from edge to defensive tackle. And I think that's a good place to overlap, because with defensive linemen, I think there's such a misconception about what it takes to be a good run defender. And a lot of people will watch, well, they ran the ball at Myles Garrett, and they always run the ball at Myles Garrett. That means he's not a good run defender. Or, you know, they run the ball at this three tech all the time, and they pick up 3 yards of carry. That means he's not a good run defender, without really understanding what the roles of these guys are against the run. Like, for the most part, a front side edge is like, he's just trying to stop that tackle from, like, getting off the ball. Like, he's trying to set that edge, and he's trying to force the action back inside. Like, that's it. Like, that's his whole role for the most part. And so I think that's a good way to start, is when you watch defensive lineman, defensive end, defensive tackle, how do you evaluate this guy's a great run defender?
I think pad level is a big part of it, right? Who gets hands on first? I think ability to read blocks is big, right? If you're getting reached on the edge all the time, that's difficult, I think, to be able to play that way. Awareness of the blocks that might happen outside of you too, like especially nowadays, like all the reduced splits from wide receivers, and whether it's a tight end or a wide receiver, I guess, out there, those things that might be coming your way, like, so you know if you're getting cracked or not, or even if a guy's just stepping down on you, and how quickly can you get outside of that block if you need to. I think awareness is really, really important. I think a lot of it's mental. Physically, most guys can be a good edge rusher or edge defender in today's NFL against the run. I think there's not been exceptions to that. I think that physically guys just can't hold up. Like, in the NFL, like, they just have – they've ruled out, especially in run defending situations, a lot of the guys that might be, like, problematic in that right way. So they're not even in those situations most of the time. So physically, most guys can hold up. It's really an awareness factor, I think, for me, like, as to whether – Can you be able to read blocks and read scheme fast enough to be able to play the way you need to? But then after that, it's, yeah, arm extension, certainly power to be able to get off blocks, right? It's one thing to not get buried, but it's another thing to be able to get off a block and pursue a player. That's kind of like the next level up. We'll talk about that a lot with defensive tackles too. But those are definitely some of the things I look for, especially as a front side edge defender, especially if you're being blocked on a play. There's kind of like different rules for unblocked situations that edge defenders have to know really, really well, because they're unblocked a lot in current schemes. But I think from a perspective of you're being blocked or attacked or run at, those are some of the most important things I look at.
Yeah. I think the trophy player at the NFL level for this is Max Crosby, right? Like, I think he's like one of one in terms of run defense for what he does off the, I mean, he's an excellent pass rusher as well, but I think just his body of work against the run is like, again, you can run at edge rushers because, again, you're just, you can pretty much X them out of a play if you want to. He's a disruptor. Like, you can think, oh, we can scheme around Max Crosby, and you can't, just because his awareness is so good. The way he gets off of blocks is so good. He's a lot of fun to watch against the run.
He and DJ Watt are both stand out in that way, and that, like, you can't really run, like, you can't run away from them or at them and be successful, and they really make things hard for teams because there's almost no good way to go about it. I mean, Watt makes more probably unblocked plays against the run than anybody except for maybe Crosby in the league. Like, those guys are just so difficult because of how quickly they process the scheme, and I think Crosby was even maybe better last year in that regard, just like the amount of play. I mean, if you watch the first half of Crosby against Detroit, your jaw's on the floor. It's just, it felt like he knew every play. I was like, how is that even possible? Like, this is a good offensive line, and he's making it look like child's play out here because of how quick he's dominating. And a lot of it is just cerebral, like his ability to process what's happening in front of him, the reaction timing, like all that stuff that isn't even tested at the combine. It's just so important. Like, your hand-eye coordination, your reaction timing, how quickly you process, like hard stuff to judge, but it's like the stuff that makes the difference in the run game, especially the physical and athletic traits themselves. Even the physical process of defending the run well isn't very different from being a great pass rusher. You're just not trying to reach an objective point necessarily. You're more trying to hold a point or control a point. But physically, a lot of this, I mean, first step is extremely important. Your hand placement and lockout and strength and all of those kinds of things, extremely important. Same thing as a rusher. Like if you're trying to rush that way, at least physically, like you want to win first contact, you want to get hands inside. One arm is longer than two if you were able to, in an edge rusher in a situation where you're able to use that to the degree that you need to. So, yeah, I think that it's a lot of the same things from a physical and athletic standpoint. Like if you're crossing the box, checking the box in one, you're probably going to check it in the other, unless you don't have any awareness or IQ, and unless you don't have the frankly, just the ability to play hard. Like that's the big thing in the run game, right? Like a lot of guys can hold their gap. Not many guys can make the kind of plays Crosby and Watt make while also playing 90% of their team snaps. So that's where the distinguishing factor comes in for them as an edge, as run defenders.
Awesome. Awesome. So let's transition fully to interior defensive linemen now. So my first question is like, you talked about your four pillars of pass rushers for edge rushers. How many of those do you think translate to an interior defensive lineman as well?
Yeah, I mean, all of them do translate. You are going to probably see a little bit more emphasis on, I mean, burst off the ball is like the most important traits, I think. So that for both, I think that's still the most important. You're probably not going to care quite as much about speed up the arc because you're not always trying to run an arc as an edge defender. You certainly can if that's your game. There's a little more ways to win, I'd say. You truly have more of a two-way go. So your hand usage becomes way more important. Your pad level's important for both. Your hand placement becomes so important. How quickly you can get to the edge of a guy is really important. So the change of direction stuff probably goes up more than the bend and flexibility, because a lot of times your path is still pretty linear to the quarterback. I mean, obviously guys like Donald can bend, guys like Elijah Kansi can bend. There's guys that can bend, but a lot of these guys have won with power and hand usage and burst off the ball. That's been like the whole package basically. And we talk about hand usage, or as you said, pass rush plan. And that really becomes just way more magnified, I think. And that's why in college, when you find a guy who can get on the edge of a blocker, you draft them high. That's pretty much just the whole story in interior defensive line. If you have a guy that has the ability to get on the edge of a blocker quickly, almost always that player is explosive off the ball and explosive laterally. And that's pretty much what you need. Because ever physically, almost all these guys are going to be able to check the box. You know, once in a while you get a weird case like a Draymond Jones. Okay, like is he – and now I guess they're preparing him to play edge. I read the other day. I don't know if that's going to end up being true. But he's always a trickier case. There are some trickier cases if you're just looking, okay, what's the outlier to what John's trying to say right now? You could probably find a couple. By and large, most guys are going to be big, have the size and strength to be able to play in there. But if you're just talking about pass rush impact, it's almost always how quickly they get off the ball, how quickly do they get to the edge of the player. Because, I mean, Dexter Lawrence, he could have success probably rushing down the middle of a player all day. But most guys are not. Most guys are going to have to be able to find a way to get on the edge of their opponent and then either counter back or win on that plane. And then winning once you've gotten on the edge of your blocker, is a lot about your bend and flexibility, your lower body strength, those kind of things, which some guys have, some guys don't. But even if you've done that, even if you can't bend and finish as an interior guy, it's almost enough just to get upfield from that position, even if you can't bend and finish. And that's why the flexibility part it matters still, but it is minimized a bit, because even if you get the quarterback off their spot, you've kind of created a success, right? Or you've broken the pocket. So if you can do that quickly, even if you have some other flaws, you're probably in a position of strength as a pass rushing defensive tackle. So I'm always going to look at things from a pass rush traits perspective first, but I will say run defense matters more for interior players than outside players, I think, because it's just harder as an interior player. The mental processing you have to have, you won't stay on the field as an interior player if you can't defend the run. And so you'll get picked on a lot more. So you have to be able to process really quickly, blocking combinations coming at you, doubles, things like that. The run defense part of playing inside, to me, is a lot more intricate and detailed and a more sophisticated conversation than the edge guys, where you really have to, like, it almost has to be an intentional, like, you don't put the same level in, whether it's in film study or – in your awareness or what you're looking for, or your physicality as a run defender, as an edge guy, to be like, maybe you're not Watt Crosby level of difference maker, but to be like an active detriment to your team as a run defender, it's almost always goes back to like an intangible rather than a tangible. Whereas as an interior defensive lineman, I think there's a lot of the intangibles and intangibles that matter at that position a lot more than they do at edge.
Got it. I love it. And I think that's a good way to juxtapose that is like Byron Murphy drafted first round of the Seahawks, right? And Michael Hall drafted 54th overall to the Browns. I think both of those players are very explosive pass rushers. Maybe Johnny Newton's a good one too, to throw, although the foot caused him to slip a little bit, right? We're talking Johnny Newton and Michael Hall are probably a better comparison than Byron Murphy. Both extremely slippery, explosive pass rushers. Like their pressure rates were absurd. The difference is Johnny Newton was touted really highly, where Mike Hall's draft stock was a little more fluid. It's because Mike Hall can't defend, there's no body of work on tape that he's a good run defender at Ohio State. Mm-hmm. And so I like that. It starts with pass rush, but if you really want to be considered one of these better like defensive tackles, like defending the run isn't optional.
And I think there's a path for Michael Hall to get there, to be honest. Like I do, you know, he is an interesting player because he really does compete as a run defender. Like it's not an effort issue with him at all. I thought, I think there's even some good moments of awareness with him as a run defender. Some of the technique stuff sometimes is pad level, even which is funny because he's not a tall defensive tackle, but when guys pop straight up out of their stance, sometimes like that can be to their detriment. I don't know whether it's you getting tired or things like that. It's hard to say, but there were like flashes of it a little bit with him, but there are also times where he's like, yeah, he gets 8 yards down the field. And so there's things that need to be developed. I don't think he's like hopeless though. What was he, 292? Mm-hmm. I don't think he's like so small that that's like an excuse for him. Like everything, he has enough to get better at that and to be not so much of a net negative as a run defender, I think. Newton to me was just such, I mean, obviously I think something
amazing. Yeah.
I like absolutely love Johnny Newton, and I thought he was the best defensive player in the draft because there were so many different ways for him to win. He could anchor and shed and get off blocks and make plays, or he could slip through gaps too. Like he could play that way. In the NFL, you don't do that quite as much as you do in college, but as players get better, they just play that way, right? They're not like being asked to do it as much maybe as they were in college, but as players play that way, they just do it, right? They just sense, oh, I can get through this gap. I know it's coming. I'm going to trust my athlete, and they just play that way. They see opportunities to cheat or cut the corner or backdoor play or concept. And so guys that have those traits are really valuable because the most important thing about all defensive line, frontline players, we're talking about the traits to get there, obviously, but when you watch and you evaluate, you're basically looking for who can make plays behind the line of scrimmage and what, like whose process allows them to be able to be able to translate in the NFL. And so that was the big question with Chris Jenkins. It was like, does he make enough plays behind the line of scrimmage? Like he's a good player. Everybody knows that. He has these traits, physical, athletic, all this stuff. Like he plays hard, but does he make enough plays behind the line of scrimmage? And it's a valid question. I thought in my evaluation at the end that he had all the characteristics to be able to be a player that does that more in the NFL than he does in college. But yeah, if he did it in college, he would have been a first round graded player for me rather than a high second. So I'm a big fan of him as a player, but you're balancing that, right? Do they do it in college? And do they have the traits? Well, Johnny Newton did both. You know what I mean? Byron Murphy did both. So those guys were awesome. Michael Hall, some of the traits are there. Sometimes the production's there. Sometimes it wasn't. Like there was kind of – I actually watched him and I said, he should be a better pass rusher than he is. Like if he was just an awesome pass rusher, like he would have been a first-round graded player for me probably. And I was pretty high on him. He was DT4 for me. But I thought when I watched him, I was like, he's just like okay as a pass rusher, but there's really good stuff there from a process standpoint. Like – you see the flash of him, and you're like, dude, do this every time. What do you like? This is why you're on the field. Like you win this way all the time. And so sometimes it's about you're weeding through reps where you don't see it for the reps that you do. Cause in the NFL as pass rushers, you're almost always you're going to have more opportunities and more green light to rush than you do in college. So anytime you see the flashes, I tend to cling to him as an evaluator and say, ooh, like he's going to get to do that more and more in the NFL. He's not going to have to deal with offenses like Michigan every single week in the NFL. Like that's not what he's going to be up against. What he does well is going to be so much more valuable in the league than it is in college. And he's going to have more opportunity to use it. So I tend to pull tightly to those prospects more so than guys who are just like solid across the board, like a Rook, for example, like good player, but like, what's he doing in the NFL for me? Like that's so special and so important. Obviously Atlanta felt like he was doing a lot for him since they gave up so much to go get him ahead of players that were better than him. But I thought he was fine. But at the end of the day, like I'm looking for difference makers, and I'm not sure he has that upside.
That was my thing with Rook. Like I watched his tape and I'm like, that's the best run defending defensive tackle in the class. Like his pad level is fantastic. His ability to drop his hips and take on two is amazing. But I didn't see any pass, like hardly any pass rush upside. Now, again, he does have athletic traits. Can they coach something into him and then pull that out? But I think Michael Hall is also a really good example of where I want to go next. And it's like role and scheme is so, so important for defensive tackles more than people. I mean, it is for every position, right? But like, I think for defensive tackles, we're talking about Michael Hall and we're like, oh, if somebody can get those flashes out. Well, guess what? He got drafted by a team and by a defensive for a defensive coordinator who loves gap shooting defensive tackles and who tends to get the most out of guys who play closest to the football. Right. So like we're saying the things that Mike Hall showed flashes are he's now playing for a defensive coordinator who asks his defensive tackles to do those things. And I think a good learning point for me was literally last year. I was really low on Kalijah Kancey because I was like, this dude cannot anchor a double. This dude cannot hold the point of attack in the run game. Like I gave him a third round grade. I was like, I don't see it. But he got drafted to a team that's like, I don't want him to do that. I want him shooting gaps. I want him even against the run, like just penetrate a gap. Just like, you know, so like role and what a defensive tackle is so important, because if I would have saw that or like, oh yeah, if that's what that team wants him to do, like, then yeah, the pass rush upside is clearly there. But for me, I was like, this guy can't play the run. So what do you want me to do? And so that's an emphasis of me of like, I missed on Kancey because of that.
Mm. Well, he was an interesting case study anyway, because we always talk about like just being careful with your outliers, right? You have to understand. That's why Johnny Newton, I was just frustrated because obviously the injury thing contributed, but like, why wasn't he getting talked about as a top? There was no, like, he isn't small. Like, you know what I mean? Like his length ended up being fine. His weight was fine. He's 304 pounds or whatever. That's what defensive tackles weigh these days. Like there's none of those things should have been a big deal. Kancey was like 281 pounds. Yeah. And so he's small for a defensive tackle for sure. And you could also just see his frame, a narrow frame. Like he didn't look anything like Newton and physically. And so he was really like a risk for anybody who was high on him. And I was high on him, but I admittedly openly that this is a big risk. Like I'm betting for him to hit, he had to test like one of the best defensive tackles ever. And he did. So I was like, okay, like I love the tape in college. I think the flashes are there. I think he can figure the rest out. Now, I don't think Kancey is ever going to be like an every down star in the NFL. Like, I don't think he's that. People have already the Pitt thing and, you know, he's Aaron Donald 2.0, like all that stuff. That obviously, you know, even people have that. That might be obvious. Like Aaron Donald might be the best defensive player ever. Kancey's, I don't think, going to be that. But I do think he can be a very important player because there may be 5, 6, 7 negative plays at the end of the game that you're like, that's tough. Like he definitely got reached in this situation. And those were there in his last year's tape. And that's all what you want. Like once he was reached, he couldn't, you know, he doesn't have great extension either because his arms are like as short as it gets basically for a D tackle. Those physical things are going to matter to him and they're going to be lead to negative plays in his career. The difference is that Kancey makes plays behind the line of scrimmage. And I went back to that principle over and over again with his evaluation. I was like, okay, if I'm going to bet on him, is he an unbelievable athlete for his position? Yes. Does he make tons of plays behind the line of scrimmage? Yes. And that carried over to Tampa. Because if you watch his full game tapes in Tampa, you'll still see some of the things you were worried about. You'll also see, like, he just gets through gaps so fast. And there's so many times in which nobody can touch him up front because he's so quick. And he's just the best athlete up front. And so he's one of those guys that is probably outside of the scope of some of what we're talking about. He's a good example of why the traits matter, right? But also, like, I thought his tape was good in college too, but there was also, like, just the concerns with it too. But he's one of those guys that you were just like, you either bet on him, he's going to be a physical outlier if he hits to the max because he's small. And not only does he weigh a little bit, he's not going to weigh much more than that ever because his frame's narrow. That's and right, small. Yeah. He's just small framed for a D tackle. But he might just be such a freak that it doesn't matter. And in his rookie year, you just saw him be a freak so often that you just weren't as worried about the negatives. They're going to exist, but you're going to live with them for the positives.
All right, John, the last thing I want to talk about here is the big boys. So it feels like there's a little bit of a return of the nose tackles. Like in the past, so there's one in 2021 and there was one this year, nose tackles drafted in the top 50. I'm trying to think of how high was Ali McNeil drafted by the Lions that year? Because Devondre Sweat was 39th.
I think he was third round, but I could be wrong.
I thought he was second round for some reason.
Maybe he was. Yeah, I'll look. Let's see.
No, third round. You're right. Yeah, shouldn't question John Ledyard on my podcast.
I really just swung it. I just guessed
that. But when we're talking about those nose tackles getting drafted with a premium asset, like what does a nose tackle have to do for you to say, yeah, they're worth taking this high?
Nothing. They can't do anything to be worth. I mean, if they're just purely a nose, yeah. Like, I mean, Dexter Lawrence, who's, you know, some people would say like, oh, you know, to me, Vea's like, and Lawrence, I mean, the nose thing is like tricky, right? Because are you just saying they can play in the A gaps, like on most of their snaps? But I would never call Dexter Lawrence just a pure nose tackle. Like, you know, I mean, he could play anywhere you wanted him to, like, especially once he developed. Like, he wasn't really that great early on, but he was just so young and he developed just, I mean, he had unbelievable physical and athletic traits. And then he just, guys that can move at his size, and obviously he had the intangibles too. That's a huge part of it with Lawrence that probably doesn't get talked about enough. That guy just wants to be great, and that matters a lot. So teams that can get inside that and figure that out. I mean, Dexter Lawrence was not this player in college. Like, you could just watch it. He just wasn't this player. Like, that's not who he was. You know, he was a good player. You could see the traits and but he got developed. I mean, he really did. And so it's to his credit and his work ethic. And so maybe you can see a player like that and you call him like more the nose tackle brand. You know, even Vea, he doesn't play that many snaps. The snaps he plays are valuable. You know, he's a really good player, obviously. He's way more than just a nose tackle. You know, he'll line up all over the place for them too. So, you know, if you're just saying like, okay, when I talk about nose tackle, I'm talking about the Jordan Davis types. Yeah, those guys I'm just never drafting in the first round. And I'm probably never drafting them in the second round either. Like, if you can't rush, basically, if you're just saying, when you say nose tackle, you're saying guys that are only going to play first down and can't rush, I'm not taking you the first two rounds probably. Like, they're just – if the game is a pass rush game, the game is a behind make plays behind the line of scrimmage game. And when I can sign Mike Pennell off the street a couple of days before the Super Bowl – and he's great against the run in the Super Bowl for sure. Don't get me wrong, but it shows you like these guys aren't crazy valuable. You know, these guys can be found. They can be replicated. And so I'm just thinking about it from a value proposition. Now, does that mean I don't love watching these players on tape? I love watching these players on tape. Like, they can be really fun to watch on tape. But just from a value proposition standpoint, yeah. Like, in today's NFL, you're not valuable enough to me if you're just a run stuffer, if you're just an early down player. And it feels like everybody knows that during the NFL season, and then we get to scouting season, and everybody's like, dude, T'Vondre Sweat, first round, before everything happened, obviously. T'Vondre Sweat, first round, dude. Like, obviously. And I'm like, do we learn anything here? Like, what are we learning here? Like, this player doesn't move the needle in the NFL, not to mention the other stuff with him that made him borderline undraftable. But, like, I feel like we've been slow to – so what? Like, we got to watch what happens in the NFL. We got to watch what's valuable in the NFL. These big body types, like if there are, there's nobody as big as Sweat, but even the closest facsimiles to that, what do they have? What do they offer that can be worth the type of value you're talking about for Sweat? Well, these guys do things. I mean, Sweat's never looked like Dexter Lawrence a day in his life on tape. He's never looked like Vita Vea a day in his life on tape. So when you look at it that way, it's like, okay, well, he can't be that prototype of player. So who is he then, you know, as a player? And you end up with just carbon copies of players who are just considered much lower value players in today's NFL.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think even last year, again, I also cover the Browns, so like that's what I'm most familiar with in comparison things to. Like, Siaki Ika was drafted in the third round last year and was inactive every single game until Maurice Hurst went down with a bicep injury. Like, they literally said, what do you want to, like, Jim Schwartz, what do you want me to do with this guy? Like, yeah. I can't put him on the field. So he literally was inactive, a third round pick, inactive up until week 13, 14, whenever it was that Maurice Hurst suffered that bicep injury and went out for the rest of the season. It's like, and you saw in the preseason too, and they just drafted two defensive tackles this year. So I think they probably learned from their mistake pretty quickly, I think. And again, I don't want to write the book on Ika either, the way we don't want to write the book on Wilson, but like,
he might need a different team. Like, he just might need a different to play. And like, it doesn't make any sense for the scheme they run.
Right. I mean, they re-signed Shelby Harris. They re-signed Maurice Hurst. They signed Quentin Jefferson. They drafted two defensive tackles.
All those guys are what? Nothing like his body type. Nothing correct. Like his.
Yeah. Yeah. So I tend to agree with you there, but John, before we wrap up here, I just want to give you the opportunity. Did we miss anything? Oh.
Good question. I mean, I think we talked about a lot of the really important stuff. Yeah, let me think. I mean, I had mentioned intangibles just quickly, like that they just matter a lot. And so motor at this position is going to matter. Now, defensive tackle in today's NFL, the rotations are deeper. And so I think that that can be considered. You don't need guys to play 60 snaps. There are so many good defensive tackles in today's NFL that you can – most teams can survive playing their top guys less and saving them for a bigger moment. So that's helpful, I think. And it's getting that way with edge rushers too. There's still teams like the Steelers and Raiders who don't believe in it. But I think that those things matter a good bit. And the intangibles of what a player is from a cerebral standpoint is really important too. You know, Robert Kimdichie is probably one of the better examples of just a player who had physically and athletically every gift that you want at the position, but he just had no clue what he was doing and he just couldn't learn it. Like, it just never clicked for him. And so, even though I think he tried, honestly, as his NFL career moved on, he got some more chances because just how good his traits were. Everybody would have wanted to try and make him into that player, but he just could never be that player because he just couldn't. The game just did not come naturally to him at the rate that it needed to for him to be a really good player in the NFL. Like, it's so those guys get eaten up and chewed out really quick. So, yeah, just look really closely for when you're with interior defensive linemen. How they process blocks is really important. And you have to watch a lot of tape to figure that out because different guys, different schemes, so go up against. I like that with Chris Jenkins. I just thought he understood block concepts really fast and he could attack one guy in a double, and that's really important. Most everybody's like, does he have the size to hold up against doubles? Hardly ever part of it, honestly. Like, almost everybody has the size if their technique and their awareness is good enough. And so most of the time it's that you're looking for is, okay, when the double comes, do they know how to split it? Do they know how to stay low? Can they attack one guy? Can they process quick enough to attack one guy? That's the best way to beat a double, is to attack one guy. That makes it harder for the other guy to get on your frame, and the guy you're attacking is now at a disadvantage because he was expecting help, and now it's 1v1, and you're in his pad. So how quickly you can process a guy, when the guy over top of you is unblocked, almost always means if you're in the A-gap or head up on the guard, the center is going to down block on you. So if he's pulling away from you, if the guard's pulling away from you, so how quickly can you process that, fight off that down block, get over top of it and make a play on the opposite A gap or B gap or wherever that play's going, but follow that puller basically across and be able to beat that center's down block so you don't get pinned. Like, all those things happen real fast, and guys who can see it and physically, whether technically, pad level, hand placement, awareness, all those things, be able to fight off the blocks that happen from that standpoint are going to be successful. And the other thing we didn't talk about, unblocked players on the edge. And I just want to talk about it because it's really difficult. Today's NFL and college football, everything now, you're unblocked a lot as an edge defender. And there's a lot of rules and responsibilities. What do you do in unblocked situations against a boot? You're stepping down usually when you're unblocked. So there's like the step down rules for an edge defender, unblocked on the line of scrimmage, and the tackle or tight end, if it's tight end you're outside of, down blocks, you're squeezing down right to them so that they don't kick you out and run inside of you. Otherwise you're screwed. Well, nowadays everything about NFL offenses are built off countering the fact that they know edge rushers are stepping down. So it's not as simple as it once was just step down, you know, box technique or wrong arm the puller and, or the split zone block, whatever it takes. Like, you know, that's all you have to worry about. Now you have to worry about boot actions. You have to worry about jets. You have to worry about everything, right? They're trying to take advantage of you in space. You have to worry about zone reads and all this kind of stuff. Every quarterback can run now. So it becomes really difficult. And in college, you'll see guys, Austin Bryant, if you remember from Clemson, was like at one point, this is going to, maybe you don't remember this, but he was actually early in the process, like, could he sneak into the first round? And I was just like, this guy's probably not an NFL player. Like, and it was just like guys that get optioned off in college and teams go in and they say, game plan wise, we're going to attack you. We're going to option off you because you can't read and move laterally enough to be able to win. Nowadays, defenses are just kicking the linebacker out and not even asking the guy to do it as much, but you're still going to see the athletic deficiencies. So it's a big thing to watch for is edge rushers and unblocked situations, especially against the run and against the pass, honestly. But that's the opportunity to play in space. Can you be an athlete? Can you read the block concept? Can you read where the ball is, right? TJ Watt's amazing at all that stuff. I think it's one of the most underrated things about him. It's just like, it's really hard to get one over on him. Like, he's either going to know that you're giving it and take the dive and usually get the back, or he's going to be able to get out of there and chase the quarterback down to the perimeter if he's trying to get outside of him. Or if you try to block him with a puller, he's going to beat that guy almost every time. So good with his hands, so good at processing, looks through blocks to find the ball all the time. He's never out of control. That's a big one, right? Some guys just go flying down the line of scrimmage. Bud Dupree, oh my gosh, he's still kicking. But that guy, like, he would just fly down the line of scrimmage every time. It's just like, okay, dude, like, they're just going to literally run right backside of where you just were, because, like, he just had no self-discipline, self-control. And so there's so much that goes into being an edge defender in an unblocked situation in today's NFL. We could probably do a whole show just on that, because there's so much intricacy and detail to, like, the process that that player has to play with. And honestly, it's so hard to be in that situation, especially against really athletic quarterbacks, that defense have done a better job saying, okay, you're just going to do one thing, and the linebacker behind you is going to take care of whatever you don't do. So he's going to read you, basically. And if you step down, he's going to scrape outside. And if you hang outside, he's going to fill. And, like, they're trying to do it that way because it's just so hard for edge defenders to play that way. So when you have the cyborgs that can do it, you're at a real advantage defensively to the way you can free up your linebackers to do some other things. Pittsburgh and the Raiders are two teams we've talked about a lot today that are examples of that. And Detroit may get there too with Hutchinson. I'm not totally sure. I haven't seen the Browns do that with Garrett. I've missed it, but I haven't seen that necessarily be the case. He will actually play inside probably more than those guys will too. And so that's a factor in it as well. Like, his usage is a little bit different. Last thing I'll say, Corey, I know I'm rambling ridiculously here. The last thing I have to mention is just guys who can move around and play in different spots. It doesn't necessarily make you a better player, but it makes you a harder player to stop for opposing offenses. It's a real advantage with you. Myles Garrett's always been amazing, but the fact that Schwartz has been able to move him around and find him matchups is really, really advantageous for him. I think he can play both sides of the line of scrimmage, obviously, but also the inside stuff I think matters a lot. Crosby can play both sides of the line of scrimmage. That's a real advantage for him. Hutchinson often plays both sides of the line of scrimmage, both edge defender spots, and obviously will kick inside as well. Bosa plays both ends as well. And it's a real disadvantage for TJ Watt, frankly, because he doesn't play both sides. He plays only the left side almost exclusively, hardly any reps throughout his career on the other side, especially since after his rookie year, I should say, because he played on the right side his rookie year. He prefers that side. It has led to him being, I think, more predictable as a rusher. A lot of guys will just flare out against him and know that he's trying to rip past them. And he was good at one point at countering inside of that move, but he didn't do it much last year. I'm not totally sure why. But coaching staffs that are willing to push guys to stepping into those different roles and to being able to move around and say, hey, I know you're more comfortable on this side. Think about it from an opposing offense standpoint. If they know you're rushing off the left side, the left edge defender spot, every single snap, outside hip of whoever is last end man on the line of scrimmage for the offense, they can scheme up, right? They know which way we line the back, which way do we line the tight end? How are we going to get to certain passing concepts that we want to get to, especially against Watt, who's going to jump up and knock stuff down? Okay, you're on the left side every time. All our quick scuff is going to go to the other side. So eventually defenses may be able to say, okay, now we know you're doing that, so we may be able to respond. But I think it's advantage offense when you don't move around as much. Some of that's on coaches. Some of it's on players. Watt needs to be more willing to move around. He said before he loves playing on left side. He's an example of a player that probably needs – and he said recently that he's maybe a little more open to that. But he's an example of one that might need to be willing to do that a little bit more. I think Crosby did that a little bit more this past year. Bosa's done it more recently. And so it's going to come a point where I think that's a really important thing. And some teams have been further ahead on that than other teams. And I think the teams that have been further ahead on that have found advantages. The teams that have been further behind on that have made life tougher for their best players. Watt's still unbelievably productive, for example, but I think life's been tougher for him because they don't find ways to test the offense's preparation with how they move them around. So just one example of something that's like a forgotten thing with the position. But in today's NFL, I think first mover advantage goes to the defenses and the teams and the players that are willing to say, we're going to try this. And like, maybe you're better on the left side than the right side. We're going to try you on the right side 10 snaps every game. So the teams will have to prepare for it and respect it. And we're going to trust that this process is going to lead to better results. And I think teams have found most of the time that it does.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to bring up, is just how much of the game is pre-snap. How much of the game is preparation, for one. So like, if you're forcing that preparation, but again, how much of the game is pre-snap? If you're forcing a team to come out of the huddle, and they know, well, TJ's over there. Like, I think this is an extreme example, but a really fun example is the Browns. Again, the Browns last year, the Titans game where they went up against the Titans. Titans come out in 12 personnel. I think it's a second long situation down a distance. And and Miles is literally moving side to side, and these two tight ends are going with him side to side. Like, that's clearly how the Titans are game planning and scheming for Myles Garrett. Is like, wherever he goes, we're sending extra help. And it forced the Titans to take a timeout because he just kept having the tight ends move back and forth, and they couldn't get a snap off. So
it's a great example. Yeah, that stuff matters a ton. Like, all the things you can do to force life to be more difficult from a pre-snap perspective on an opposing quarterback / formation or concept, right? Like, none of that stuff can be set until they know, right, where you're at when you're that type of a player. And I just mentioned the top guys because those are the guys that are going to command the respect, but it's important for other players too. And most other players do it because they have to. The top guys can kind of say, hey, I only want to play this center. Hey, I prefer doing this. And I just think there's a real advantage to being able to say, hey, we're going to move you around and we're going to see how offenses respond. And then we're going to dictate some things we do as the game goes on off of how they respond to whatever you do. And it's been a huge part of why Cleveland's been so successful under Schwartz is it's not just Garrett, but Garrett is like the key piece, right, of doing all that. And now it's created all these easier matchups for other people. You also have Za'Darius Smith, who, like, he was one of the, you talk about first mover stuff. That was one of the first things, right? I mean, he was unbelievably productive as he was a good edge rusher. And then they moved him inside in Green Bay all the time on long and late downs. And he would just crush. And then he went to Minnesota and he did the same thing. He and Dana Hunter would stand up over the guards. And it was like, teams were just freaking out. And it's the kind of stuff that, like, puts you in these hard situations, because if they do rush 1v1, you've got an advantage. And if they sign help to you or change their protections, you're going to have some advantage elsewhere. Or they just had to do something with their concept they didn't want to do. They wanted to play you straight up. Now they can't because you're matched up over – your Danielle Hunter matched up over a guard, and they can't play you straight up anymore. They can't do what they want to do. They can go to a counterpunch, and maybe you don't have an answer to that counterpunch. So maybe it still works out for them, but you force them to come off their initial process. And I always think that's just a good technique to have in your back card. So those types of players can allow defensive coordinators – to do that kind of stuff from a preparation standpoint, which is why they're so important to have. But whether or not it happens or not requires player, team, coach, all that type of buy-in.
I'm fired up. Like, I'm ready to pull a bender, make myself a pot of coffee, and just watch edge rushers all night long. I'm calling off tomorrow. I'm calling off work tomorrow. I'm just watching edge rushers all night long.
The purest position in the game, man. But edges and D tackles, man. It's just, there's nothing like watching that position. It's an art.
I love it. All right, John, again, tell the people where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Ledyard, LEDYARD, NFL Draft. I do the Audibles and Analytics podcast a couple times a week. Usually we record, we talk about Ollie Connolly. If people follow him on Twitter, he's unbelievable. The read optional Substack that he has. We do crossover episodes and record together several times a week in and out of season. In the summer, actually, which is coming up here, obviously people are not going to be able to hear as much of that podcast. My full-time job keeps me very busy in the summer, always taking some much-needed vacation. That guy doesn't actually sleep or rest ever. So we'll probably be back closer to training camp doing episodes for that. But we're probably about as in the weeds from like a scheme technical process standpoint as most pods will get, I think. Ollie is way more football knowledge than me. And so that's the kind of content we do. If people are interested in that, like, what's the process? How is this team being successful? How is this player being successful? Is this scheme right for this player? Those kinds of things are a lot of what we talk about as the season gets underway. And then I do the In Snow Ball podcast as well. Which is a Steelers focused podcast that most of your listeners probably wouldn't tune in for, but do that one as well in season and in the off season as well. So those are the main things of what I do. I work on some film stuff for SB Nation on the Lions and the Chiefs in season and some in the draft season as well. But I wear a lot of different hats and mostly just love watching and talking ball. So at Ledyard NFL Draft on Twitter is the best place to do that with me.
Heck yeah. All right. Well, John, you are officially a friend of the Daft on Draft podcast, and you're more than welcome to come back anytime.
I appreciate it, Corey. And I appreciate you, A, having me on, but B, thinking about topics like this and wanting to do content on topics like this. I am kind of a nerd in that on the football side of things, obviously people have heard that, but also in just like the media space, like people who are forward thinking and desire to talk about topics in more detail, I think, than other people are willing to go to. And willing to produce content that's outside the box like that are the people who are successful, A, but B, also provide fans with content they can't get anywhere else. And uniqueness is one of the most important principles of good journalism. And that obviously carries over right into podcasting and audio mediums as well. And so I think topics like this are really important. Hopefully they're educational to fans as well. So I'm really excited to be able to listen to the other ones you do as well, because I think there's just going to be a lot to be learned, and I can't wait to hear different people's perspectives on scouting different positions, because I'm not that good at scouting all these positions. So it's going to be really fun for me to hear from other people's perspectives on what works and from a scouting perspective at different positions.
I appreciate that, John. I really do. But that is it for this episode of the Daft on Draft podcast. Again, Apple, Spotify, the two big things. Other than that, it's bedtime. So until next time.